problem that I'm discussing than the previous one. So I should say this is joint work with my co-author Peter Winkler, who's at Dartmouth. First of all, just to show a few pictures, these are some pictures I collected off the web. If you Google dendrimers, so a branch polymer, another name for a branch polymer is a dendrimer. These are some pictures you can find. So they actually do, people do study these things in various fields. This is some artificial hemoglobin for making artificial blood. In some, I don't really know what this is all about, but this is a sort of a two-dimensional picture. This is a three-dimensional picture. So just to show that branch polymers, you know, sometimes occur. I mean, even a two-dimensional branch polymer is an interesting problem to study. This is kind of an interesting picture created to, this is some sort of molecule which is created to gather light, maybe for doing artificial photosynthesis, whatever that means. They call it light harvesting molecules. If you look on the webpage, it's really amazing, sort of science fiction. The light comes in from one side and it gets somehow concentrated in the little laser beams coming out the other side of the molecule. I don't know how that works. My talk is not about these kind of sophisticated problems, but I'm going to study just the most simple mathematical problem you might imagine for branch polymers, which is just take the space of branch polymers and try to say something interesting just mathematically about the most simplest possible model. So, I should say that feel free to interrupt me during this talk because if I go too fast, I won't use my allotted time. So, and using a computer talk, I always tend to talk too fast, but so slow me down if you need. Okay, so what is a branch polymer? It's just going to be, we're going to be studying branch polymers in two dimensions and three dimensions. Let me just start with the first half of the talk, which will be about two-dimensional polymers. So it's just going to be a collection of disks in the plane, which is connected and non-overlapping. Okay, the interiors don't overlap. Right, to normalize things, we're going to put one branch polymer centered at the origin. Okay, the branch polymers are labeled. I guess the labels are a bit dark, but we're going to label them 1 through n in some way, all possible ways. Okay, but the one at the origin is going to be labeled 1.
What's the meaning of the different labels?
There's no meaning whatsoever. It's just that some of the forms, all labelings are equally equiprobable. Okay? But you'll see in a minute.
Generically means almost surely.
Generically means almost surely. So, that's right. We allow polymers which have cycles. For example, if I move the 5 over so that it touches these 4, that's certainly allowed, but we're going to be putting sort of the natural Lebesgue measure on this space in which almost surely it'll just be a tree. Okay, so Xn here, that's going to be the space, the set of branch polymers with n labeled disks. You can make this into a topological space, of course, but in the most natural way. Okay?
So I'm also worried about the labels.
Okay, so
I can't see.
The space has.
Are you going to regard the permutation of labels as a different configuration? Or
yes,
not?
I am. Okay. So right now the space is not necessarily well. Okay.
And then otherwise it's just Lebesgue measure in the square to the nth power subject to the condition that everything is touching. That there's one cluster
and none overlap.
Well, I haven't told you exactly what the measure I'm putting on spaces, but it's not going to be exactly that. It's not going to be exactly that. Well, it will be in certain cases, but we're going to measure polymers according to the angles between adjacent polymers. So we're going to use the Lebesgue measure on the surface. If you look at the points where or the angle between adjacent centers, and you just use the angular measure, so d theta. And to describe a polymer, all I need to do is, starting from the origin, I look at the sequence of centers going out, if I tell you the angles of those centers, that will describe the polymer. So you can think of the polymer as parameterized by these angles along the tree. And so you can, if you like, you can embed this space Xn into some space 2 pi to some large power.
But who decides when it branches?
When it what?
Branches.
Okay, so for each particular tree, topological type of tree, I'm going to have some space. Okay, this is important because,
you're going to decide the topological structure.
I'm not, the topological structure is not determined in advance. However, this polymer has a certain topological structure. If the 5 moves over and touches, I can move the 5, first it touches there and then continues around
so
here.
So to be absolutely
the topological structure can change.
Site number 1 is threefold coordinated. How did you decide that?
I didn't decide that. I took all possibilities. All possible topologies are allowed. Okay, Lincoln.
So for each
topological type, I'm going to have some subset of the space of angles.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but that subset is going to contain some polymers which have cycles. And when I have a cycle, I can break the cycle in different ways, and that's the way I move between components.
Can you see the next slide, please?
You'll see that in a second. Ask me in 2 slides if you still don't understand. Okay, so here's the natural questions. What does a random branch polymer look like? So here, I have to be a little bit more precise what I mean by random, but hopefully we'll see that in a minute. What's the diameter? What's the number of leaves? What is the topological type typically? Is there some sort of scaling limit when the number of balls gets very large? Can you rescale and get some sort of random fractal shape? Another question, which is even more vague, does the space Xn, the space of polymers with n balls, have some nice geometric structure? Right? A priori is just some defined by a bunch of inequalities on points and on labeled points. But can you impose a nice geometric structure on the space? And you'll see why. This question is sort of a natural one. Well, once you look at the theorem here, so the inspiration for our work on this was this paper by David Bridges and John Embry in 2002, the Annals of Math, where they computed the volume of this space. Okay, so again, I'm measuring the volume in terms of these angular variables. So the angle of 2 pi when you go once around this.
What is the second angular variable? I think I know the first one. What's the second one?
What do you mean the second angular variable?
Well,
the 3 dimensions.
Just
look at the surface measure on a, look at the solid angle.
Okay.
The surface measure on a sphere in 3 dimensions. Well, okay, so in 2 dimensions, yeah?
Between the center of the n one and the center of the n plus first one? Or
yeah, if two are connected, then you have local coordinates which are just given by the solid, the angle, the direction of that vector.
Okay, so tell me how to walk from one to the next.
Yes. So here's the result. The volume of Xn, this space measured in terms of the angle, is an integer multiple of 2 pi to the n minus 1. And the multiple is just n minus 1 factorial. Okay. So in particular, if you forget the labels, you can just ignore this factor and you get a very interesting number. Okay. 2 pi to the n minus 1.
But what's the measure of all your space here, the space of all angles? How many angles in?
Well, so this comes back to Lincoln's question. Any polymer can be described by n minus 1 angles, right?
Okay.
Because it generically it's just a tree and you just measure the n minus 1 angles. That gives local coordinates for a piece of the space. And in those coordinates, you use the Lebesgue measure for those angles. Of course, the space comes in different parts for these different coordinate patches, but the patches are nonetheless connected to each other because when your polymer makes a cycle, then that corresponds to several patches coming together.
So the 2 pi to the n minus 1 just tells you that they almost never touch? No.
It's extremely non-trivial. I don't know any way to see this immediately. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Because there is a combinatorial factor of the number of trees.
Let's look at the next Let's look at this slide. And you'll see. Hopefully this will answer several questions which have been raised already. Okay? I can see that everybody's way ahead of me. So in X2, okay, there's two balls. You put one at the origin. The other one has a 2 pi possibility. Okay? So the volume is 2 pi. How about when we have 3 balls? Let's do a little calculation here. So there's three different kinds of combinatorics, right? Starting with the 1, you can put the 2 on the 1 and the 3 on the 2, or you can do these in the reverse order, or they can both be on the 1. Okay, these are the only three possibilities. And in each case, well, in this case, for example, when you put the 2 on, there's a 2 pi possibilities, and then, but the 3, there's only 4 pi over 3 left, because the 3 is not allowed to overlap the 1. So this is the volume of this part of the configuration space. And each space has that same volume. You add them up, and you get a multiple of 2 times 2 pi squared. Okay. Now, if I had prepared a slide with 4 balls, okay, you would have seen that there are actually two different topologies. There's one where one in the middle, and there's one where they form a chain of length 4. And the volumes are, again, rational numbers times 2 pi cubed, but the rational numbers are not simple rational numbers, like 5 twelfths or something. Okay. So the theorem is somewhat non-trivial. I mean, it's non-trivial because you're adding up these rational numbers and you get an integer in the end.
But in line 3, do you get again 2 pi and not the area of the sphere?
Well, the area of the sphere is 4 pi in terms of solid angles. So you shouldn't worry about that, at least that part of it. Okay. The volume in 3D is again a multiple of 2 pi to the n minus 1, but now the multiple is n to the n minus 1. And again, but now if you forget the labels, you have to divide this thing by n minus 1 factorial, so it's not an integer anymore. Okay, so this theorem is more general than stated. In general, they relate branch polymers in D plus 2 dimensions with the hardcore model, the hardcore gas in two dimensions lower. Okay, so there's a relation between the partition function here and the partition function there. Very simple relation.
In terms of that, it's kind of clear why they can treat 2 and 3 dimensions. So
exactly.
Are you going to treat every dimension?
So in this talk, we're only treating the 2 and the 3-dimensional case, okay? Right, so 2 minus 2 is 0. So this result is related to the 0-dimensional hardcore gas, which is sort of kind of trivial. And this result is related to the 1-dimensional hard disk model, hardcore gas, which is also pretty easy to compute. So if you read their paper, they're using some fairly sophisticated techniques, equivariant cohomology, and our motivation with Peter to this work was to try to make an elementary argument. After all, the answer is very simple. Why can't we make a combinatorial proof of this result, which might lead to some more stuff? And that's what we arrived at. So the key observation, which in fact they didn't make in their paper, but it's essentially there if you read carefully, is that, here we are in 2 dimensions. The volume of the space doesn't change if you change the radii of the disks. So the radii can be all different, but still you get the same volume of the space, as long as you continue to measure in terms of the angles. Okay, so the angle here is still 2 pi, even though the radii are different.
You have the sum over the different labels. Because the
certainly,
the number,
certainly in this case,
the numbers are not rational anymore, right?
That's right. In this case, if you it's important to have the labels in there. Let me just convince you that this lemma is true with 3 balls. So in 3 balls, here's my configuration, and I got 2 pi possibilities for the first ball, but the third ball, now there's some angle to compute to determine the volume of this part of the configuration space. Okay, if you look at this triangle here, theta 1 is the minimal possible angle between the two smaller balls. And so the volume here is going to be 2 pi for the first ball times 2 pi minus 2 times theta 1 for the third ball. The second ball you stick on there. And notice that of the three configurations, when you add up these contributions, one of them is going to have the theta 1, one of them is the theta 2, and one of them is the theta 3. And so when you add those up, the sum of the angles adds up to pi. Okay, so it again comes out to be a multiple of 2 pi. So this shows, I mean, that wasn't supposed to be funny, but you're amused by it. Okay, so let's, before I prove the lemma, let's go ahead and compute the volume, assuming the invariance lemma. So the idea is, here's how we can compute the volume, assuming the lemma is true. Well, we're going to take disks of extremely different radii. So let's let epsilon be a small number, and we're going to take disks of radius 1, epsilon squared, and so on. Okay, and now we're just going to compute the volume for these disks, and that'll be the same. Well, in this case, when epsilon is small, we can essentially ignore configurations of the following type, where a very small ball is stuck between two larger balls. And the reason is that there's essentially no angular freedom for the two angles here. You know, these two balls, well, you should think of these two balls are really huge, and they can't wiggle. There's no wiggle room left. And so the volume of this part of the configuration space is going to be, well, go to zero, negligible, as epsilon goes to zero. Okay. So we only need to consider configurations where the balls are attached in order of decreasing size. Okay? So you plop down one, then two is the next biggest ball, then three has to be attached to either one or two, four has to be attached to either one, two, or three, and so on. And so when you attach ball I, it's got to go to one of the previous balls. First you decide which ball it's going to be attached to. There's I minus one choices. And then you can attach it essentially anywhere on that ball, because ball 3 is so small compared to 1 and 2 that it's got essentially 2 pi choice. When is this bit which goes to 0? Okay, so that's how much choice you have for the ith ball, and you take the product of those over all I, and it gives you the formula. Okay. So why is the invariance lemma true?
Is the invariance lemma only in two dimensions?
Well, no. There's some version in three dimensions, but we'll get to that. Okay. But thank you for the question. Here, so remember this slide, just, you know, the sum of the angles of a triangle is pi. So here's the generalization when you're talking about an n-gon. The sum of the angles of an n-gon is some constant, right? If you have k quantities whose sum is constant, and then you look at the one forms d theta 1 up to d theta k, and you form this big wedge product, this k form, well, it's going to be a k minus 2 form, because you take the wedge product, but you remove two consecutive ones in all possible positions, then the sum is 0. Okay, this is just some sort of algebraic fact, which is very easy to prove. What it means geometrically is a little mysterious to me. Maybe somebody knows really why this is true, but anyway. The idea is that you just take the expression, you can substitute d theta k minus the sum of the others, and then you see that everything cancels. Well, the idea is that we're trying to compute the volume of this big space. What we're going to show is that the volume doesn't change when we change when we change infinitesimally the radius of some ball or many balls. Okay, so we're going to change the radii of the disk continuously. Now, as discussed by many people, the space has a bunch of different components, one for each topological type of tree. When you change the radii of the balls, each of these components, the volume, its individual volume is going to change, right? But as the volume of one component increases, the volume of some adjacent component is going to decrease. So we have to figure out how this volume gets transported from one component to the other. And that's this picture here. So, in a component of a particular topology, right, the boundary of that component is, it happens when two disks touch. Like, here's the tree that given by the solid lines. These two disks might touch. Now, what happens if we want to change the radii of one of these balls infinitesimally? If I try to keep the angles fixed, all these angles along the tree here, fixed, and I try to increase this ball, what's going to happen is there's going to be some overlap. So we're going to be losing volume out of that component. On the other hand, because let me just do this picture first, and then I'll, on the other hand, this topology is also sitting at the same point in the space of polymers, and there, if we increase the size of that ball, there's going to be more freedom, so it's gaining volume. So the point is to show that in this process, when one component is losing volume, there's another component gaining volume, so the net volume change is zero. And can everybody see the angles there? So here there's a pentagon, and if I want to measure the local volume form, I can use the angles which I've drawn in here. And in particular, three of the angles of this pentagon are relevant. So I can, if these didn't quite touch, then I could jiggle all of those angles by a little bit, and that would be my local volume form. The local volume form is going to be the wedge of these d thetas. And when I change the topology, I'm no longer using these three angles, I'm using these three angles. And there's five choices of trees, right, obtained by removing one of those edges at a time. And so the sum of the d thetas, the wedge of these three thetas, over all possibilities adds up to zero. That was the lemma. And so that shows, essentially, that shows that the volume change in these five components adds up to zero. Well, okay. That's the idea. Okay, nothing more complicated than that, but it does involve some sort of, differential geometry. So this allows us to give a, let me start over. This allows us to actually do a perfect simulation of a 2D polymer in the following way. We start with our ball at the origin, we attach the second ball. Now the third ball starts off being tiny compared to the others, and we're just gonna grow it, and we keep growing until it gets to unit size, but if at any point it touches one of the other balls, it'll form a cycle. Right? Then we have to, we can't grow it anymore because then it'll start to overlap. But the lemma says that in that cycle, we can break a different edge, and then the thing will be able to continue growing. And we're going to choose an edge at random. We're going to flip, it's a Monte Carlo algorithm. We choose the edge that we remove at random so that the, using a detailed balance condition so that the total volume changes stays the same. So you can see that. Once the third ball has grown, we just choose a new ball somewhere at random on the boundary, just using Lebesgue measure, and start growing the ball there. This was something that Bridges and Imbrie didn't know how to do, but follows from this invariance principle. Okay, so you can certainly let this run longer, and you'll get some large polymer. So here's the one with 500 balls. There's another one. Okay, so that's the end of the story.
There are no cycles. Right?
There are no cycles in this picture. There's some very close cycles, but. Probably one that's no cycles. Okay, so let's talk let's talk about the three-dimensional case. Yes?
By perfect, you mean this is a linear algorithm in M, yeah?
No, by perfect, I just mean I've got an exact random sample.
Oh, as far as entropy.
What is the entropy? Exact distribution.
It's the exact distribution of around.
That's what induces a national distinction. You haven't told us what national
I did tell you what the measure is. It's the Bayes measure on the space
of
But you don't produce every configuration with the same probability.
I do. Every configuration, with respect to the uniform measure on the space of configurations, that picture was a uniform random branch polling. This is a uniform random branch polling with 500 volts.
Because typically, when you produce them, at least in the polymer physics community, you have to reject always every configuration in which you produce overlap.
Yes, but so this algorithm, I'm happy for this question, this algorithm avoids those issues, right? It produces a uniform random sample, and I don't have to do any rejection sampling. Okay, so it's much quicker.
But it will be the same distribution.
It has the same distribution, but it doesn't involve any rejection.
This one looks strange, so strange in one direction.
Yes,
sorry. This is
some of them, you can see from the simulation that sometimes they're bent up and sometimes they're long. I didn't do any study of the sort of the eccentricity of these polymers.
The question was the typical branch polymer. No?
What is that was the question, that's right.
But it's not so unlikely to straighten this one up, right? I mean, you just move two branches and you straighten up, so it's not unlikely to have sort of things.
I think the answer is that the typical branch polymer doesn't have a limit shape. It does have a random shape in the end, and sometimes it's long and thin, and sometimes it's more circular. But I didn't make any sort of study about the eccentricity of the polymer, but that's something which we could naturally do.
Physical situations when there's some part interaction or some repulsion between branches. It leads to some type of, there's some scaling.
This is the physical
situation. Some scaling. You have greatest scaling as the number of poles
yes.
at some point.
Yes. And I don't know the scaling in two dimensions. Well, are you worried about this picture?
Yeah.
I'm telling you it's a sample. It's a perfect sample.
Don't worry, be happy.
Okay, be happy. So let's go to three dimensions. Again, there's an invariance lemma. It's stated a little bit differently. Okay, so now you can't just change the volume, the radii of the balls. It's not true. Okay, it doesn't work the same way. So for three dimensions, it's somehow easier to talk about just the centers of the balls. And so the hardcore condition, instead of being that the Euclidean distance between the centers of the balls is bigger than or equal to 2, we're going to change two of the coordinates are going to get scaled in some sense, in this sense. That is, instead of using this norm, we use a norm which we've scaled at y and the z coordinates by the same factor of beta. Okay, so this means that the two points are outside some, there's some ellipsoid centered around one of the points, and the other point has to be outside that. Okay, and the invariance lemma says that the volume of the space doesn't change when you replace your hardcore condition by this more general condition. So, in fact, the beta here can be different for every pair of points in your polymer. Okay, and the proof of this invariance lemma is essentially identical to the one, the two-dimensional version.
If you think of this as space-time, you just change the radius in the the two-dimensional spatial coordinate without changing the radius. Right?
Yes.
So is the anisotropy in the same direction for all?
Yes. Yeah. So we have to pick the x one of the directions, which we might as well call the x direction, and so we're only changing the y and z coordinates for all pairs. Right. So all these cigars are lined up in the same direction. Okay, so again, we do the same story. If we want to compute the volume, assuming the invariance lemma, we're going to take these betas now to be all very different from each other. Okay, so in fact, let's let beta grow like epsilon to the one over I, beta I. And so you could think that this is there's some sort of cigar-shaped hardcore repulsion where the cigars are getting thinner and thinner. And so as beta goes to infinity, essentially you've just got a line segment, and line segments never intersect in R3, so there's essentially no interaction when epsilon goes to zero.
Now, is this the reduction of the two dimensions, basically, what you're doing?
No, it's not going to be a reduction to two dimensions, but...
No, by two dimensions, that you basically collapse two dimensions to zero and
yes.
Okay.
So this is, it is dimensional reduction, but it's some sort of, it's the geometric interpretation of what physicists would call dimensional reduction. Mm-hmm.
So it's the RT plus 2 to RT and the hardcore reduction of
yes.
the end of...
Yeah, so there's a corresponding invariance principle for any dimension. So the key observation that we use in three dimensions here is that if you take a sphere and you project it to the x-axis, then the surface area measure on the sphere projects to the Lebesgue measure on that segment, just unit Lebesgue measure on the segment. So this is that principle discovered apparently by Archimedes. And there's a corresponding theorem for any sphere, any dimension. If you take the d plus two dimensional sphere and you project it onto a d minus, a d dimensional space, so two dimensions lower, then the image of the surface area measure on the sphere is going to be the big measure on the ball, two dimensions lower. Okay, so let's take our 3D polymer with all balls of the same size and project the centers to the x-axis and relabel them so they're in increasing order, x1 through xn. And if we want to compute the volume of this of the space of polymers, we can compute we're going to integrate over all possibilities for x1 through xn of the n-dimensional volume of the slice. The co-dimensional volume of the slice. Okay, so if we look at the set of three-dimensional branch polymers whose centers project at these points here, again, there's a formula for it. It's a multiple of 2 pi to the n minus 1, 2 pi to the n minus 1 times an integer, again, just like in the two-dimensional. Like in the big theorem. And this integer, how do you compute the integer? What's the integer? Let's see. You start from the left endpoint here. You look at all the points in this set, which are within distance 1. Those are the points which have a possibility to overlap with the ball. And you call that n1. So n1 is the number of x's to the right of x1, which are within distance 1. And 2 is the number of x's to the right of x2, which are within distance 1, and so on. You take the product of those numbers, and that gives you the volume of the space of 3D branch polymers. And so once you know how to compute the volume of this, you just need to integrate this quantity over all possible projections. And so where does the lemma come from? It's essentially the invariance principle. It's the argument. It's the same argument that we used in two dimensions. You think about x1 as being a ball, and then x2, think of x2 as being like a cigar, and x3 an even thinner cigar, and so on. And so you're going to attach, first you're going to attach x2 to x1, then you attach x3 to either x2 or x1, assuming that it can stick on those guys, assuming that it's not too far away in the x-coordinate, and so on. Well, essentially, the role of the beta, the increasing betas, is that when you attach a particular point on, you can ignore everything to the right because they're sort of too small. Okay. Well, that's the lemma. That's the idea behind the lemma. It is a generalization of a two-dimensional case. Okay, well, there's some special cases here. If all the points when you take the 3D polymer, if they all project to an interval of length at most 1, then each of the ni's is just I minus 1, and you can see that the volume is 2 pi to the n minus 1 times n minus 1 factorial, which is the same as the volume of the space of two dimensional branch polymers. And this is not really, shouldn't be really surprised, because if you have a 3D polymer and all the points when you project to the x-axis line at interval length 1, that means the 3D polymer, all the spheres, it's essentially a planar polymer. So if you intersect the spheres with some plane in the middle of this interval, then it looks like a 2D polymer. Yeah. Okay, well, another special case is not so important, but okay, well, the question now becomes, we have this lemma which tells us the volume for a particular set of x1 through xn. These are, the projections of the points along the x-axis. Wouldn't it be nice if we could say something about the distribution of this set of points? If we take our uniform random branch polymer, three-dimensional branch polymer, and project the points, what is the distribution of this set of endpoints on the line? Well, okay, so here's the answer. Here's how you can get the same set, a set of endpoints with the same distribution. You take a random tree on n vertices, a combinatorial object, just a random labeled tree on n vertices. To each edge in that tree, you assign a IID random number, IID uniform number between 0 and 1, a length. Okay. Then you pick up the tree from the root and you shake it so that everybody hangs down. And you look at the distances from the root. So let xi be the distance of the ith vertex from the root. The x1 is 0, that's the root vertex. And then the claim is that these endpoints you get, which were the vertices of your tree, they're now on a line, and these are equidistributed with the projected points of your branch polymer. So, this is just an illustration of what I just told you. You take your random tree on, in this case, 17 points. Each edge, you assign it an x coordinate, x length, which is uniform IID. You project everything, and then you get this set of endpoints. And the claim is that these are these points are equidistributed with the points of a projected 3D branch polymer. Even though the polymer doesn't have this combinatorics necessarily. Okay. Well, a corollary to this result is that, this kind of process we understand very well. We understand very well what the random tree looks like, and putting 0, 1 lengths is a trivial operation on a tree. So you can get the diameter. You can get the diameter and all the statistics of this measure are, I think, well understood. So as a corollary, you can get that the diameter of the branch polymer with n balls is of order square root of n. And in fact, you can get much more accurate. Properties of the distribution of that. No.
There is a corresponding result in D equal 2?
We don't have one. See, this is it's kind of a funny situation where we understand more about three dimensions than two dimensions. Usually it goes the other way around. Three dimensions is hard, two dimensions is easier. Okay, so this allows you to do a perfect simulation. Again, perfect simulation, I mean I've got an exact random sample of a 3D branch polymer, and it's also elongated, but don't worry about it. If I turn this thing around several enough times, you can convince yourself that it's a tree. It's not so easy. You have to pay attention. So let me just give you the idea of the proof of the last result, which told you the distribution of the projections of the endpoints.
So 10 minutes.
10 minutes? Oh, I got plenty of time. Well, we don't want to be late for Professor Vanderbilt. Okay, so again, let's let x1 through xn, now they're in the on the x-axis, these are the projections of the centers of the branch polymer. And for the purposes of this exposition, let's just take a special, consider a simpler case where the projected points are half integers, okay? And so, for example, we have n1 is the number of points which projected the origin, n2 is the number of points which projected the point and a half, and so on. Now, if you go back to the lemma from 3 slides ago, you can compute the volume of the set of polymers which has this particular set of points. Just it's this combinatorial quantity here. It's the product of these ni. And if you do that for this set of points here, n1 through nk, this is the number of, this is the, well, I should have said two, the volume of the volume of the space of 3D polymers with this set of projections is 2 pi to the n minus 1 times this integer, right, which comes from the lemma. And well, if you take into account the shuffling of the labels within each of these, because all these points are identified, you should divide, it's appropriate to divide each of these quantities by n1 factorial, n2 factorial, and so on, and they become binomial coefficients. Okay, so this is the part of the configuration space of 3D polymers which has a property that when you project them, you get these multiplicities. And this quantity, you can actually recognize it as something else. This is actually counting, this combinatorial quantity is counting rooted planar trees which have ni vertices at level I. So here's a planar tree. You have a planar tree which has certain levels, right, distances from the root. You have n1 vertices at within distance 1 of the root, n2 at within distance 2 of the root, and so on. I mean, at distance 2 to the root. How many planar trees have this particular combinatorial structure? Well, it's given by that quantity. In order to make a tree which has n1 vertices here, n2 there, and so on, well, you have no choice between this level and this level. The root has to be attached to everybody on this level. But between these two levels, you have choices, and the number of choices is some binomial coefficient, n2 plus n1 minus 1, choose n1. Okay? And so if you take the product of those binomial coefficients over all the levels, you're counting just rooted planar trees with ni vertices at level I. Okay, so this gives you a bijection between branch polymers which have this particular property here that their projected points lie in 1/2 z and some combinatorial objects, these planar trees. And so now if you change the 2 to 1 to 3 or 1 over 10 or 1 over 100, you can do the same combinatorial trick, except that now you're going to be counting planar trees where the edges can go from level 1 up to level k, if this is 1 over k, and anywhere from 1 to k. Anyway, that's enough. That was supposed to be a sketch of how the proof goes. Let me just end on a couple open questions. The formula on the first slide and the second slide, the volume of the space of two-dimensional polymers is 2 pi to the n, if you forget the labels. And 2 pi to the n, of course, is the volume of a torus, an n-dimensional torus. And so which sort of begs the question, is there some dynamics on the space of polymers, on the space of two-dimensional polymers, looks like just translation on a torus? It's natural to try to take a polymer and start rotating the balls around, but then you have to worry about what to do when they collide. So this is the question: is there some natural geometry on the space that we just don't see right away that would give some homeomorphism from the space to a torus which preserves the measure. All right, the other question which was already discussed a little bit, can we say something about 4D polymers which would then tell us through Bridges and Imbrie's result something about the 2D hard disk model, which, well, of course, that's where the money is. I should mention that all the results which I talked about, except for the very last one, have analogs for 4D polymers. There is this invariance principle there is a version of this lemma too for 4D polymers. And again, the space is going to be 2 pi to the n minus 1 times an integer. And so this integer can be interpreted as a tuck polynomial of a certain graph. The question is, can we integrate that over the space of all possible graphs, the appropriate graphs, to say something about the 4D polymers? And again, in three dimensions, we computed the diameter. What can we say about 2 dimensions? Is there some simple idea that we just haven't seen yet that would tell us something more about the 2-dimensional?